You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony. Angela Slatter is the author of the gothic fantasy novels All the Murmuring Bones, The Path of Thorns, The Briar Book of the Dead, and the forthcoming The Crimson Road. She's the author of supernatural crime novels, including Vigil, Corpse Light, and Restoration, and short story collections The Girl with No Hands and Other Tales, Sourdough and Other Stories, The Bittersweet Bible and Other Recountings, and A Feast of Sorrows Stories, and the novellas of Sorrow and Such, Ripper, and The Bone Lantern. Thank you for joining me. Angela, your newest novel is The Briar Book of the Dead. What a wonderful book. This did not come out instantly, did it?
It did not. It's been a kind of a long gestation. I initially wrote it as a novella. So it was 32,000 words, and I knew it wasn't right and it wasn't finished, but I didn't know what to do to fix it. So probably 3 or 4 years later, I figured it out. I'd written enough novels by then that I could sort of work out what I needed to do with it. And I heard a review describe it as a cozy, like a gothic cozy kind of thing, because it's all in the one location. And I think that's actually pretty accurate. It wasn't what I was going for. I was very aware, okay, well, this is basically a one location story. But that's kind of how it turned out, as a cozy with witches and all the gothic accoutrements and all the fairy tale stuff. So it's a few years, but we got there.
You know, as I started this novel, I was thinking that it was just so masterfully written as a novel to introduce us to, you know, this whole second world fantasy, the world of Sourdough and Llewellyn. You introduce a whole bunch of new characters and you set up a really interesting situation. You do it so effectively and so compellingly. And I'm thinking, this is the kind of thing that you could use to teach a class. And I also knew at the same time you do teach writing. Have you considered using the opening of this to teach writing? And also, on the other hand, how much did teaching writing inform your creation of this?
I haven't used the start of Briar Book. I have used the start of All the Murmuring Bones from a few years ago, because that's kind of about when I want to talk about using description effectively, using a highly descriptive opening effectively, because, you know, mileage varies. Some people want to go straight into the action. So, you know, if you're using basically a whole chapter to give a history of a place and a people, how do you make that super interesting then when even, you know, your agent, who says, normally I hate opening descriptions, said, I couldn't move away from this, you know. So, and Briar Book is interesting because, you know, in terms of teaching and stuff that I learned, it didn't initially have that little opening of Ellie, you know, dreaming about that time in the woods when, you know, her, it's quite a trigger warning kind of opening with that, with the cutting and everything. But it was sort of straight into a lot of the admin of, you know, the Silverton and this family, and how do you run a town and how do you keep everyone safe? And I was always really aware that needed to be interesting, because bureaucracy is not necessarily the most interesting thing to have in a fiction book. And my editor said, you know, we need something else at that start. So that was me, you know, learning as I went along and just sort of saying, oh, well, how do we throw a reader straight into the characters and their shared past together? Because I think that was really important. You know, you can go in and say, oh, yeah, well, this is a family, but it's a pretty weird family, and there's a lot of a lot of history that goes with them and their relationships that informs the whole book. So that was what I dug into then, was, you know, was this ceremony where Ellie feels like she's failed. You know, she's failed her whole life. She's failed to be a witch. She just doesn't have any magic or anything, but she's been born into a family of witches, and she's the first non-witch in 300 years. So I was thinking, well, if you feel you're a disappointment to your family, imagine how bad she feels. Imagine what her life is like. So it's that idea of referring to the weight that's going to be on this character her whole life to sort of start the book. When I teach, I tend to use other people because it's easier to analyze other people's work. And I generally fall back on good old John Connolly, one of my favorite writers. So.
Hey, he's a wonderful writer. You know, one of the things that struck me, you know, as I'm reading this book, I'm about halfway through, I'm thinking, this book is a totally feminist book. It's all about women. They run everything, they do everything, they move all the action, and I've hardly noticed that. You do it so smoothly. And I think that's really, it's an important book in that way, just in the history of feminist literature, I would imagine, to be such an effective second world fantasy based entirely, you know, on women.
And I mean, if you, I'm a huge fan of Marjorie Liu's Monstress graphic novel as well, which has a similar feel, is that, you know, the men are there, but they're not necessarily running anything. And the whole thing with the Briar witches and this family is me thinking witches are always, they're always hunted and loathed in, you know, history books and fantasy books. And what happens if there is one place where they're safe, where they run things, where they have the tiniest bit of church oversight, but they manage to subvert that fairly, well, I want to say subtly, but it's not really. If you seduce the priest, it's probably not very subtle. And how, you know, one of the other characters says, you've all grown wild. Other witches are, you know, running and hiding and constantly under this weight of fear that they're going to be burned or drowned. You guys grew up wild. So what happens when you don't have that weight of fear on you, and your kind developing? How do you become? So that was kind of the thought around that, and I like the idea that, you know, rather than your village witch at some point being turned on and betrayed, that the people of this town, it doesn't ever occur to them that any misfortune comes on the heels of these witches. It's, you know, they have looked after us for 300 years. Why would we think they're going to stop now? So there's a degree of support there from you know, underneath as well. So I just sort of had to think about what kind of a world they then create in this fairly large sort of town.
We hear a lot about a lot of novels are considered mosaic novels, and that's a style where you just show kind of like blackouts of different characters and they all connect together. What you're working on here is a really interesting variation of that, which is a mosaic series where each novel can work entirely by itself. Yet they all refer to back to one another, and the entire motif of most of the novels and the references within is of the fairy tale. So talk about using the fairy tale to create a mosaic series.
I mean, because I started out to, I did a master's and a PhD in basically fairy tales and how they work. and how we use them to pass on information and warnings and ideas and that kind of thing. And so that when I did my mosaic collections, the first one was Sourdough and Other Stories. That was the kind of thing I was working with, the idea of the mosaic and what if this character that you see in first person here can be seen in the next story, but at a different age and from a different angle and a different position in life. So how does someone else see it? Because those point of view things always change how someone appears, you know, who the person who might appear to be an interesting and strong leader in one story might actually be a tyrant in another story. So I like this idea of the puzzle pieces of this world that don't quite connect, and that's how you get your mosaic. You don't have you know, an entirely cohesive view. Time is a bit of a fugue, and they've all been told stories about each other that may or may not be history. And then so the that was kind of my training ground on that, was Sourdough and Other Stories and the Bitterwood Bible and, you know, ultimately The Tallow Wife and Other Tales. And then when I sort of got to the point where I thought I could write a story big enough for a novel in this world, that was what I started to do with All the Murmuring Bones. But I thought, you know what, you've created a huge world and a huge mythology with all the previous work. Why wouldn't you use that as the myths and legends and the history that forms the basis of the novels? So I kind of, you know, when I was writing to amuse myself, I accidentally created a world and a history. And then I had that moment of, hey, you've done a lot of work, you should use that. So it's always interesting to sit down when you're plotting a new one as well and just go, what is there that I maybe haven't explored very deeply but can actually be a really good foundation for this? And one of the ways that Briar Book came about was that I had written a novella called Of Sorrow and Such. That was published in 2015. And I really loved the characters and I felt what happened, you know, I was asking what happened to them afterwards. And so I had the character of Gilly there, who was the foster daughter of the witch patients, Sykes, in that book. And I thought, well, they went on the run. You know, the girl went on the run with Sandor. So what happened then? So I wanted to explore what had happened there. And whether Gilly, who had a lot of insecurities in Of Sorrow and Such, did she manage to overcome them, or did they sort of break her world later on? Because she never overcame them. You know, she was always functioning on a bunch of lies to make herself feel better. So that's kind of the basis there. And it's I love that bits and pieces from here and there, and you can turn them. You can turn these tales, and it'll make things look quite different. So that's kind of how I'm working with fairy tales and mosaics.
Well, one of the great pleasures of this novel is the characters often will stop and refer to a fairy tale, and it'll just be a short little snippet of story and just a tiny lesson. And we can intuit, you know, if we've read some of the other books, you can see, okay, that refers to this whole big story over here. And it really gives the novel a feel of a quilt, in a sense. And you do very well at creating this kind of tapestry. That's the other thing that struck me as I read this novel. It feels like a wonderful tapestry. And I'm wondering, you know, do you sew?
I do not. I am completely craftless. I have no talent in that area. My mum is a really good quilter, And my sister is a really good cross stitcher, so they have all the sewing genes. I am more about, you know, telling stories in a quiltish fashion. So,
you know, earlier on you referred to bureaucracy, and it was just a delight to see the way that you created the civics and the civic relationships of this world. It's really fun to explore that because it makes perfect sense, and it's like somebody like taking apart a really complicated clock and saying, look at how remarkable each of the parts is. And you do that in prose and with characters and as your plot advances. So talk about creating the world of the Briar books in Silverton within the world of Laudell, and then, you know, to keep within the rules of the world you've already created while building out new details in this new novel.
I mean, and I'm kind of at the point where I've written so much. I've done 3 mosaic collections. I've done 4 novels now. Four novels now set in this world, and a couple of novellas and some short stories, and I really need to be keeping track of it. So oftentimes I'm just going back to my own books or you know, searching electronic files. I think, and I've said this before to people, I mean, bureaucracy and administration is the most boring thing in the world. But if it's done badly, you know about it really quickly, and you encounter systems that just don't work. So I kind of, having been an administrator at universities for a lot of my life, I'm interested in systems that work properly, and how you make it appear seamless. You know, it's like effortless writing is never effortless. So it's like effortless administration is never effortless. You know, someone is always keeping things moving. And I think that probably, you know, follows on to my, to how I structure a novel as well, you know, that, and I'm very aware of it's an organic system. So if you move one thing over here, you know, at the start, it needs to have a knock-on effect elsewhere. You know, if it doesn't work in the system, if it doesn't move apart, then it doesn't really have a place in the novel. So if you're doing something, let it have a function, you know, in these systems. So I think that for me was the little bit of a challenge. How do I write a novel which has a huge element of administration in it that isn't boring? So, you know, because you can hear readers going, oh, my God, administration, I don't want to read this. You know, when I just read a procedures manual from the Senate or something. So it's it's about intertwining the unreal part of life with the entirely too mundane part of life, you know. So trying to find a balance there. So hopefully I managed to get that right. So.
Well, also, too, this book is a wonderful look at power and powerlessness in terms of, you know, women and their place in society. And there's a great part where you say, the folk here, hardy and obstinate, know they owe their survival to the briars, not to the godhounds or their deity, not to something the existence of which there's no proof, unlike the power of the briar witch. And I think this is a really interesting dissection of religion and power and putting power where it belongs.
Yes. I'm a big believer in a separation between church and state. you might have picked that up from the book. It's not that subtle. But the other thing with this book too is that it's really important that the briars never get too big for their boots or assume entirely that they know what's best for everybody, you know, or try and impose their will. So it's, you see through the book Ellie and her, you know, her grandmother Gisela at some point always testing the waters of what the town thinks, what the people think. You know, Gisela always had her, like, her sewing circle once a week. So she would have, you know, women from the town who would come in and they would sit around, they would do their knitting, they would do their quilting, they would make their daughter's wedding dresses, you know, or their son's wedding clothes, and they would talk. So it's this idea that women talking, what you know, is belittled as gossip, is actually information that men think is worthless and they ignore, except for the fact that their wives go to these sewing circles and sort of say to the bride, which, oh, well, you know, my husband's considering doing this, you know, I don't think it's a good idea. He's going to come to you and ask for this, you know, and there's a kind of an understanding between all the women here that they're giving up and they're exchanging information, and they're moving the flow of life in the village, you know, with these, it's like a rudder. So, you know, rather than the king sitting in his golden castle putting down pronouncements, there's a sense of, the word has left me, consultation on a bunch of levels, which is, you know, the overt one and also the covert one.
They take their pollsters.
Mm. Exactly.
You know, it seems too, I really like the idea of the city running the government in control of most things, that kind of local control keeps the power, the amount of power anybody can wield within the city is not that great, although within, for, you know, the greater world, but within the city, everybody's pretty much, you know, just trying to get along. I like that vision. And also, too, you're ahead of your time because I just heard on NPR this morning a story that in the past, in the U.S. at least, most of the houses were one generation. It's like myself, my wife, and my sons, they all have their houses with their wives. And we're now moving towards a time when there are multi-generations in one house. And you have this with the Briar Witches. There's three generations. And I love the interplay between the two. So talk about creating the family, Ellie, the powerless witch, Gisela, the kind of scary grandma, Audra, who seems like the good witch, and the rest of the witches. Was that planned or was that created in the moment?
It was kind of planned. I mean, and the original novella form, I thought it needs to be kind of a family that's been broken but pushed back together. And so what I had was that plague years ago that wiped out all of Gisela's daughters. So she had lost three daughters in that, but she had these four granddaughters from different daughters. So it was that idea that, you know, grandparents at one point of life thought they could, you know, that the house would be empty, you know, and they'd occasionally see the grandchildren, but she's kind of had to back up and raise a second lot of children, which I think happened to a lot of Gen Xers actually as well, you know, that people ended up raising their kids for a variety of reasons. So that was of interest to me. And how do you have these little girls who have, you know, have absent mothers through no one's fault, there was a plague, who were brought up by these two older women, a great great aunt Maud and grandma Gisela, but they're also brought up to with an idea of service because they're all being trained to various parts of keeping this town running. And again, it was that central idea with Ellie. How is your life when you are entirely different from your family? When you're the black sheep kind of thing. So there's, a fair bit of channeling there. How do you survive when everyone around you looks at you and says, "Oh, you're weird." But in this case, it's not because she's a witch. It's because she's really not a witch amongst a bunch of witches. And again, that idea of how do you keep, because they're not just a family, they're kind of a business, they're a government. So how do you keep, and that's the duty, that's the obligation, that's also the source of their own lives and their own power, is keeping this town running and keeping people safe. And they take it very seriously. So that has to come ahead of any infighting, any, childish nastiness, picking on each other. But, as you kind of see through early in the book, Ellie and her cousin Nia never lets it go that, Ellie's this powerless creature. So she's sort of always a bit of a the sibling who picks on you, or the cousin who picks on you. So I wanted to look at where are the cracks in this family? How do I put cracks in this family? What's the emotional and psychological knock on for them through their entire lives? And also the idea of people changing, because Audra's mother was the only one of the daughters who actually survived for a while from the plague, but it changed her. So she became quite dangerous. So then again, it's looking at that person, someone you've known for a really long time in a particular way, who suddenly changes quite considerably. And it might make them interesting, but what else? Again, it's a system. The world is a system. It's an organic system. What is the knock-on effect of that? So that's one of those things I'm, was planning about, and a lot of conversations with myself about, okay, well, if she does this, what effect does that have on not just the family, but also the world? So it's that sort of conversations with self that look quite strange from the outside. Generally, it's best that I've, no one's watching.
You referred to this book earlier on as a cozy, and it kind of is. I mean, in that, I love the way that you integrate like the elements of mystery into second world fantasy. So talk about that, creating a mystery. This is early on. We meet Ellie. She's powerless. She does discover she has something like a power, but it's not witchcraft, and it helps her. It's a problem. It's a power that crime solvers would benefit from.
I didn't. That's the thing. I've always been a huge crime reader and a true crime reader, but that's always been my relaxation reading, and particularly as I've written more, that's what I go off and read is crime. So I think all of those, someone once said that all of the crime you've read over the years has just settled in your brain, so you don't think about it. It just bubbles up and gets into the other stories. So when I was writing Briar Book, I wasn't thinking I was writing a cozy. I was thinking of it more of as an excavation kind of a book, about family histories and what happens when sins don't stay buried, because they never do. Something always comes out, and that's a huge part of the Briars, because you don't retain power somewhere for 300 years without knowing where a few bodies are buried, because you put them there yourselves. So no spoilers there. But the four novels that I've done in the sourdough world, the All the Murmuring Bones was kind of a quest novel, fleeing from one place to another, looking for something. The Path of Thorns was a character going into a closed environment and, for want of a better word, really fucking it up. That's what Asher Todd did. And then you've got Briar Book, which is that, again, that closed environment, but you're looking at it from the inside than the people who inhabit it, and that's that sort of cozy village element. With the Crimson Road, the one I've just handed in, that is back to the kind of the pursuit novel, so one location to another, in pursuing a goal, but also having someone pursuing you, which makes life a bit difficult. So I think I've just got all of this stuff in my head from my reading over the years that it's like the treasure box of, you know, plotting techniques and not even sort of thinking about it. Oh, well, you know, I'm writing a gothic novel. Quick, let me find a crime trope or technique to use in it. It just happens. It's everything that's in my brain that I've got access to, you know, while my memory lasts. So,
Ellie, the supposedly powerless book or character in this novel does have a power, and I don't think I'm even giving away any spoilers because I think it's actually on the dust jacket. Good, okay. Well, it turns out she can talk to the dead, and as Brian Lumley once called them, the great majority. And there's quite a few of them hanging around Lodellin or Silverton, and one of the best characters in the book is her grandfather, who is great-grandfather, who is long dead. Sandor, I mean, he is a fantastic character. Talk about having a character who's a ghost.
Yeah. Again, like, and because with these books, I don't necessarily want to do what's been done before, so it's a matter of working out the rules for my world, you know, and how do they appear? What do they do? And again, Sandor was a character who appeared in Of Sorrow and Such, and I thought it was just such a nice character, you know. So what happens if he reappears? Because when you've got ghosts, and Ellie, she falls in her, you know, at the cemetery, and there's this whole legend of Silverton is that there are no ghosts because 300 years ago, Gilly Briar, the first of us, banished them. And then she falls and she cuts her head. So there's blood, and there's this old tradition, not just in my world, of that's why everyone used to wear black at funerals. So the ghosts couldn't determine who was who, so they didn't know who to follow home and haunt. So in doing this, Ellie is, you know, she's wearing black, but suddenly she's got red on her. You've got red on you, the good old the deadline. So she's seen, someone can see her, and she can see the ghosts. So there's this exchange there. So this girl who goes from being completely non-magical suddenly has this power. And her guide in all of this is her ever so great grandfather, Sandor. So we get to hear from him more than we ever heard from him in Of Sorrow and Such, because I just thought he would be really interesting because he's this solid, stable guy, you know, the father of this dynasty along with Gilly. What's he going to know? Why has he been hanging around for all this time? What does he need to do? Because it's the whole idea that, you know, it's not that because you've got sins or unfinished business, you stay around. It's if you think you feel, if you're guilty about it, you know. So it's like the unfairness of life that some murderers and terrible people quite happily go off to the, you know, the eternal sleep. They don't hang around. But if it bothered you, if you've got a conscience about it, you hang around. So you've got, because the story's too easy if you can simply, you know, summon up the person you need to talk to all the time and get every answer, because that's quite literally ghost in the machine. It's too easy. So you might not get the exact answer, but you can get some answers off to the side that lead you to other information. And I thought about, like, I thought about my mum's dad, who was, you know, a very kind grandfather. And I think I, you know, channeled a bit of him into Sandor. Just, you know, you could always ask him something. He was always really approachable. I always enjoyed writing those scenes between Ellie and her grandfather, because you've got that link of family, but previously there, you know, there's been no contact because he's been dead for 300 years. But sort of you've still got this kind of weird bond, and how the Briars talk to each other kind of hasn't changed over the 300 years.
One of the interesting episodes of this book involves postpartum depression. And I think you do a really fantastic job of exploring the emotion, exploring the effects, and doing this all within your second world fantasy. So talk about that, because it's a great character study to the way it works out in the book. Discuss, you know, like applying, you know, very modern medicine and making it seem obvious to a society that has essentially none of the high tech that we have.
Yeah. I think a really important thing with the book was, in terms of medical stuff, having doctors who listen, you know, medical staff who listen, and a lot of that is women. Having women treating women rather than a guy sort of saying, oh, you know, have you thought about going for a walk? You know, for your variety of lady problems that, you know, have nothing to do with me and I have no interest in. Because one of the things that I sort of looked at in The Path of Thorns was the idea that of a class of midwives being wiped out by, you know, doctors, clever doctors coming up, you know, and not being interested in anything that they couldn't experiment on. And I think we've seen a lot of that in history, that, you know, women's medicine has been some pretty awful experiments, you know, cutting women across their pelvic bones for the purposes of cesareans, and that kind of thing. There was a huge lot of that in Ireland in the 50s and 60s, which is terrible. You know, this whole medical misogyny and destroying women's lives and bodies, and not really taking much notice of it. So it's a bugbear with me. And I just sort of thought, you know, postpartum depression, it's not a new thing. You know, we didn't suddenly invent it. It's something that's been happening to women for hundreds and thousands of years, because, you know, your body chemistry changes, everything changes. It's not a fun experience. And I say this as someone who doesn't have children. So, you know, I've seen it happen in family and friends around me, that how awful this can be. But oftentimes we're just, oh, well, you know, we've just got to get on with it, haven't you? Rather than someone going, oh, okay, how about we respect the life of the mother as much as, you know, anything else, and try and make sure that she gets healthy. So I just sort of thought, you know, again, it's the idea. What if there is some kind of respect for female health that goes through? But also, you know, poor Deirdre, it doesn't really go too well for her. But, you know, they do try. And you know, I kind of why I chose her name, because like it means tears or sorrow. So it's just like, well, that's very subtle, Angela.
She's wearing the red shirt.
Pretty much, she's basically my red shirt, poor Deirdre. But it was just, you know, I thought it was a good place to start in terms of also the kind of entwinement in the life of this town that the Briars have. Is, you know, it's not just that someone's out there looking after your facilities, it's that someone's looking after your health in terms of your midwifery and your postpartum health and this sort of thing. So, you know, the Briars are in it, and they're trying to help, and they're, you know, trying to make lives a bit easier. Because I don't think we have a huge number of civic bodies and governments doing too much for people nowadays with any kind of obligation, you know.
Well, I found this to be a wonderful, the politics in this novel, though they're not super important, are really kind of exciting and delightful, because it just works. It makes a lot of sense without making a lot of noise about it. And that's what's really important. Now, one of the things, too, of course, there are economics in this novel, and what the most pertinent are the economics of witchcraft, in that, as you alluded to earlier, witchcraft runs on blood. So to talk about that, because that all ties in to the bigger story of the novel.
When I first, you know, started writing about witches, I thought everything has a cost, basically. So what's the cost these witches have to pay? You know, if you're going to an altar and you're making sacrifices, that's your cost. But what if it has to be personal? And then what if the bigger the magic, the bigger the cost, which again, you know, as you say, that's economics. So you've got witches who, you know, and that if you're going to do a spell, you cut yourself, give a little bit of blood, you do the magic, that's your red price. But because the Briars, and again, this is that whole idea of them having grown wild, them growing differently to another witch who's just trying to hide who she is all the time. Every morning they do a little ritual cut, and that is buying the price of the magic they will do for the day. So it's like their credit card, it's the Crimson Price card. And you can't know how much you're going to use, but it's basically this sort of little workaround that they have come up with, that, you know, we'll give at the start of the day from whatever we'll do with the rest of the day. So the rest of the day is not interrupted by a bunch of bloodletting. So I think that's probably as much as I can give without some spoilers on that one.
You know, at one point in the book, one of the characters is looking for the Bitterwood Bible, which is, of course, a reference to the earlier book. And she says, thus far, I've not found the true Bitterwood Bible. And this is certainly a unique Rick reaction. It brought to mind not well known, but except by me, a quartet of novels by Edward R. Whittemore, the Sinai Tapestry Quartet, where the characters are all in search of the true Bible, which simultaneously confirms and denies the validity of all religions. And I like the idea of, you know, one of your own books being this powerful Bible in another book. Talk about, you know, the book within a book effect.
I think Probably one of my, I mean, clearly I love books. I have an obsession with books. You know, they're doorways.
Well, one of your characters is a bookbinder, and you talk extensively about the limited editions, and I love the limited editions. Let me just take you down one question here. Will there be a Tartarus Press version of this?
Probably not, but
Oh.
but we don't know. So it's again, it's one of those things that's up in the air at the moment. Like Titan have the reprint rights to Sourdough Bitterwood and the Tallow Wife. So next year they'll be bringing out like a compendium of those three you know, sort of sourdough books that readers can go to who haven't, you know, haven't been able to get the Tartarus versions, and they'll be a bit more widely available, which will be fantastic for readers. But yeah, you know, who knows what the future holds, Rick.
Okay, we'll talk about let's get back to books within books.
In books, one of my favorite stories is actually The Name of the Rose by Umberto Eco, and also Foucault's Pendulum. So again, very much about books and false books and falsities, you know, and that idea of, you know, both confirms and denies religion kind of thing. I love that duality. And in previous books, there's the whole idea of the Little Sisters of St. Florian at the Citadel, and they maintain knowledge. So, good or bad, they take it into their citadel libraries and they send out their wanderers who are scribes who write things down. So, legends and histories and lives, little and large. So, again, it's that idea of scribing and writing things down, and whether or not it's true, it becomes part of this gigantic melting pot. And again, you know, my fascination with the idea of rumor and gossip, and is it true or isn't, or is it true in this part of the world but not in this part of the world. So yeah, so books within books within books is always really interesting to me, and I think probably Foucault's Pendulum's interesting in particular because there's the idea of books that you read, you lose. Actually, I think that one might be Name of the Rose. A book that you find, you read, you lose under some circumstances, you're never able to find it again. There's no record of it anywhere. But then one day you stumble upon a mention in another book, a reference to this particular book. Yeah, that is from The Name of the Rose, which is Adso's manuscript that sort of disappears with a lover that, you know, so is never seen again. I'm fascinated by that, you know, the possibilities and all the empty spaces around that where other stories might occur. So I think that's a big thing for me is how if I'm telling these tales, they both are and are not the basis for the world. So you get little differing tales because one person will tell you one version of the story, one person will tell you another. And you see that with fairy tales across, you know, you have a version of Cinderella from ancient Greece, you have one in China, you have, you know, you've got the French versions. That's really fascinating to me. They're all slightly different. They've got a similar spine, but their wings are different, you know, and their legs are different, a bit shorter, and then they've got larger heads. So I just really, again, that story within story and book within book are just things I'm probably a bit ridiculously fascinated with. So I like to just kind of weave that in to whatever I'm doing.
So, as I understand it, you've just finished the next novel in the series, The Crimson Road. And that suggests one of the things that I liked about this book, and I'm curious if you're ever going to explore, is the lands of the Leech Lords. They sound fairly awful, which I like in a leech.
And and again, it was, I didn't, when I started to think about, vampires in this world, I didn't want to use the word vampire because it's not our world, it's that off to the side version. And I thought about, there are all these different names for the creature that is the vampire. Vampire is just the one that's gotten the most currency. Because it's kind of cool and it's easier to say than a lot of the other ones. But I just wanted something different. So I thought, okay, what's the nature of the very cool nature of the vampire? It's leech. It sucks out souls, it sucks out blood. It takes the very core of you. It takes your life. It takes who you are. So that's how we got the Leech Lords. And I thought, how have they started? And I cover some of that in the Bitterwood Bible and other recountings is the start of that. And I've touched on it a bit in other stories, but in the Crimson Road, we actually find out where it started, and we connect it back to the citadel at Gwen's Reach. We connect it back to the first of the blessed scribes, Mercianna, whose books always appear through my books, as big reference collections.
Gar Abdul Al-Hazard.
Yes, exactly. So that's kind of where I'm going with that. It's more about where did they come from? What are they doing? Because again, we've got another. I didn't realize I was so fascinated by economics. But we've got another economy kind of thing, which is in the Darklands. The economy is based on blood. So you have the Leech Lords who run towns and estates across this space. And generally, the people who are, their folk in the town, or their, their feudal minions, they kind of, part of their feudal duty is giving blood. So a smart leech lord looks after his people, a smart farmer looks after his cattle, makes sure they're happy, gives them decent lives, doesn't kill anyone unreasonably. And what a lot of these leeches have are what they call wine presses, which are very happy, well-fed young people who once a month are dinner for, for the Lord, Leech Lord and Lady. And then, they're not killed, they're just fed on. And then they spend the next month building up their strengths and, eating and drinking merrily and being quite happy. So nice work if you can get
Yeah, I think they call that Hollywood. But
yeah, pretty much. Again, leeches. But then you've also got, not everyone's lovely and delightful, and not everyone cares enough to look after their cattle. So then you've got other enclaves in the Darklands where the humans are not treated well at all. The other thing with the Darklands is that 300 years ago, a barrier was put up, so the leeches can't leave there. And that part of that is related to the Briar Witches, who hold the border. So in the Crimson Road, it starts with the character called Violet Zennel, who lives in a harbour town called St. Senwyn's, and she's the daughter of a rich man, but he came to his fortune by a fairly awful means. He dies, Hedric dies very very quickly in the story, but he his actions echo, because one of my big things is, you know, sins of fathers, sins of mothers, and how you have to deal with cleaning up a mess that's not your own. And it becomes very obvious very quickly that Violet is sort of thinking, well, you know, my life with my oppressive father is done. I am now a rich heiress. I can, you know, I can go to sea if I want. I can buy the books that I want to buy. I can, you know, do whatever I like, except she can't, because he has left very specific conditions in his will as to what she must do in order to inherit this money. And Violet kind of goes, you know what, I don't need money. I'm not doing this shit. You're not going to keep controlling my life. And then two assassins appear at her house. So she kind of realizes it's not just the money, it's, well, can't spend money if you're not alive. Gotta do dad's bidding, don't want to. But one of the things I've done, and I really hope it works, is that she meets the heroines of the previous three books. So she meets Asher Todd, she meets Mirren O'Malley, and then she meets Ellie Breyer. So I hope it works.
Well, I cannot wait. The new novel by Angela Slatter is The Briar Book of the Dead. Thank you for joining me, Angela.
Thank you for having me, Rick.
You're listening to the Agony Column News Report, featuring interviews, phone interviews, reports from live book events and festivals, and conversations with readers. You can find additional news, interviews, book reviews, and more 5 days a week at the Agony Column website at trashotron.com/agony.